I've been framing the discussion in one way that I think I have certainly found helpful, and I hope others do too, which is that to say that there's not just one pandemic right now. There are really two concurrent pandemics. The first one, of course, is the pandemic of the virus. But the second one that is closely tied to the first is a pandemic of anxiety. And I want to be really clear that I'm not just using that as a figure of speech. I'm actually quite serious about that. I think that anxiety is reaching epidemic proportions, and I think it has major consequences for how all of us, and certainly how leaders, organizations of any size, lead.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, IPAoffthecouch.org. Thank you.
Welcome, everyone, to today's podcast. I'm Dr. Stephen Rolfe. I'm an analyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia and chair of the American Psychoanalytic Association's Committee on Corporate and Organizational Consulting. I'm managing principal of Rolfe Advisory and specialize in psychodynamic leadership advisory services for CEOs, family enterprises, leaders in crisis, and leaders with psychiatric illness. Our guest today is Dr. Kerry Solkowitz. Kerry is the president-elect of the American Psychoanalytic Association. He serves as a trusted advisor on people and culture to some of the world's most well-known and respected CEOs and corporate boards. He's the founder and managing principal of Boswell Group, LLC, a management consultancy based in New York since 1998. Trained as a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, Dr. Solkowitz advises on a range of issues, including leadership challenges, CEO succession, management team and board dynamics, merger and acquisition integration, high-stakes hiring assessments, and corporate culture change, in addition to coaching CEOs and senior teams. He counsels boards in a wide array of industries, from startups to family-controlled enterprises to the Fortune 500. Kerry is a graduate of Harvard College and the University of Texas Medical Branch. He is now a clinical professor of psychiatry at NYU School of Medicine, where he received the Distinguished Teacher Award. He also received the Edith Sabshin Teaching Award from the American Psychoanalytic Association. A passionate advocate for human rights, Kerry is the past chair of the Board of Physicians for Human Rights, a global human rights organization that shared the Nobel Peace Prize, and he also serves on the Advisory Council of Acumen. Kerry, welcome to our podcast. I first wanted to congratulate you on the recent election. You're now, of course, the president-elect of the American Psychoanalytic Association, And it's hard to believe the election was only 6 weeks ago, as it really seems like a lifetime.
Thank you, Steve. I'm honored to have won the election, but I agree with you. It feels like a distant memory at this point.
You've obviously taken office at a most interesting time. I wonder what that's been like for you. What are the special challenges you faced and you see for the organization and for individual practitioners?
Well, Steve, it's been a surreal experience. I'd begin by saying that I became president-elect on the same day that Bill Glover became president. And while Bill and I have known each other for a number of years, we have been speaking on a at least daily basis, really since the coronavirus pandemic exploded onto the scene a number of weeks ago. And fortunately, Bill and I have a great working relationship, and we are really aligned on just about everything. And so we've been working very closely together to try to help lead the association through this momentous and really challenging time that we're all living through.
Maybe you could say some of the things that you've tried to do as far as the association is concerned, and what you see practitioners facing. Obviously, there's been the transition that we've all had to working virtually.
Yeah, it's been really challenging for all of us. When it became clear what was happening and how this thing was evolving in such catastrophic ways, Bill and I talked, and certainly the executive committee as well has been deeply involved in this on a if not day to day, certainly week to week basis. And we're also trying to keep the executive council, which will soon be officially called the board of directors, also entirely up to speed on what we're doing. Essentially, our first and foremost objective, Steve, was to do what we could to ensure that our members were safe and doing what they can to remain healthy, they and their loved ones and their patients, and then to rapidly assist them to the degree that we could in transitioning almost overnight to working virtually. You know, what had been a somewhat controversial topic in some quarters about the use of virtual technologies became a moot point in the sense that everybody had to immediately start working virtually or really not work at all. And so we have tried a number of things to assist them as an association. We've encouraged them to do that in the early days of the crisis when there was a little bit of hesitancy on the part of some who weren't accustomed to using these technologies so fully. We've had one town hall for all of the members. Actually, it's beyond just our members. We opened it up to all psychoanalysts around the country, regardless of their professional affiliation. Then we're having another one this evening. We have appointed a COVID-19 advisory team to work closely with us and with the executive committee, a team of people who have deep expertise in the use of these virtual technologies, and to provide everything from training and support and sharing of experience from those who have been doing this for a long time. And we've also set up a dedicated email list to broadcast information that is helpful to our members, as well as have a dedicated section on our APSO website, again, as a resource to both our members, to practitioners, but also to patients and prospective patients. So we've been doing a lot, Steve, to try to help this along, and it has been both exhausting and gratifying and really continuing, because it goes without saying that this crisis is far from over.
Speaking of exhaustion, I think one of the comments I've heard repeatedly from people that have made this transition to virtual work is how exhausting it is.
Well, it is. I think that even those of us who have some experience using Zoom or Skype or what have you, there's so many different technologies, doing it all day, every day is an entirely different experience. You know, sitting in front of a screen for 8 or 10 or 12 hours, however many it might be, is emotionally draining. And we're really learning about this as we go. There's no playbook. I was asked recently in another interview that I did, what are the best practices for employing these technologies in this way? And I thought about that for a moment. I said, well, you know, really, I think we're inventing these best practices as we go.
Yeah. You know, my colleague, Harvey Schwartz, who's been doing many of these podcasts, has been interviewing analysts from all around the world, really talking with them about what it's like to practice in their locales. And given that New York is essentially the epicenter of the virus in the U.S. at this moment, at least one of them, perhaps you could say something about what it's like in New York right now.
Sure. Well, as you know, Steve, but I'm not sure all listeners do, I live in New York in the West Village, and but I'm not in clinical practice anymore. I haven't been in about 20 years, although I was in full-time practice in the early part of my career and have been in the consulting world and in business for the last 20, almost 25 years. But I'm sitting here talking to you, looking out my window at what would ordinarily be a beautiful and inspiring view of the Empire State Building. But then I look down at the street and they're empty and it's a ghost town. And New York, which is my beloved and adopted city, has gone from being a source of joy to a place that frankly feels menacing right now, given the catastrophic medical situation going on in the city. You and I happen to be talking today at a day that is either at or approaching the peak of the incidence of people being ill with the virus. So it's a difficult place to be right now. It's a tough time for New York and really for the whole country and the whole world.
I know that you have done a lot of work with the Physicians for Human Rights. I'd like to hear you speak to what your organization, that organization in particular, is faced with right now and some of the things that they're trying to do, obviously, with the focus on healthcare workers being at the front of all of this.
Yeah, it's a critical time for Physicians for Human Rights. For those listeners who aren't familiar with the organization, PHR as we call it, it's a global human rights NGO that's based here in New York, but does work all over the world and shared in the Nobel Peace Prize back in the late 90s for our part in the effort to ban landmines. We are a group of healthcare professionals and other professionals who, you know, bring medicine and science to bear to investigate and document human rights abuses around the world, and also to advocate on behalf of those who are victims of those abuses. Our work shifts depending on what's going on in the world, and certainly right now the pandemic of the coronavirus is top of mind for everyone. There are a few things that I think we're particularly concerned about. One is clearly the rights of healthcare workers to be able to take care of others in a way that is safe for them, and clearly that has been challenged by the worldwide shortages of personal protective equipment, and so we are making a big deal out of how important that is to get that equipment to those healthcare workers. In addition to looking after the rights of healthcare workers to be able to practice medicine in a safe way, another major issue that PHR is focused on in the context of the pandemic is to make sure that we don't forget those people who are still living in parts of the world where they are experiencing ongoing and egregious violations of their human rights. It's not as though human rights violations just stopped when the pandemic began. These conditions, whether they are in Syria or in Myanmar, or here in the United States, it's going on. These things go on all over the world all the time, and they don't come to an end when something that's more dramatic seems to supersede it in the news. And so to make sure that those people who are on the receiving end of human rights abuses are not forgotten at a time when their living circumstances are already difficult, and then to make sure that they too have access to appropriate health care and protections from this devastating virus. So it's a difficult time for the world right now, and I think it hopefully is a time when Physicians for Human Rights can rise to the occasion. I think we are trying to do that and make sure that the people aren't forgotten.
Well, I know that's only one area that you're working in terms of leadership, but before we get into speaking about your work more generally, with leaders, I'd just like to take the opportunity to hear, maybe you could share with the audience some about how you think about the psychoanalytic association in general, and some ideas that you have for the association in terms of your longer vision for the organization.
Sure, Steve. I think that my longer term vision, which I tried to lay out during the campaign over the prior few months leading up to the announcement of the election in mid-February, my vision for the association isn't changed. Clearly, what we are focusing on today is quite focused on dealing with the pandemic. But longer term, I see APSA as being an organization that continues to open its doors to not only the traditional kinds of members that we have, that is practicing psychoanalysts, but also to psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapists, to academics who are informed in their daily work by psychoanalysis, but who may not ever practice clinically, to others who use what I think is an antiquated term of applied psychoanalysis, because I think in a sense all of this work is applied psychoanalysis, so it's a kind of redundant term. But I see APSA as being an increasingly warm and congenial, welcoming home for everyone who works in a way that is informed by psychoanalysis, both as either clinically or intellectually or in some other way. I think that for me, one of the things that binds us together as psychoanalysts, and this is part of the vision that I not only was campaigning on, but I just feel deeply about in my bones, is that I think that there are some basic values that psychoanalysts have. Not that we have a unique cornered the market on these values, but I think that they are unique in some ways to psychoanalysis. Values of listening, of taking time, of the fundamental equality of all people. They're basically human rights values. And so I think that my vision for the American Psychoanalytic Association is that it's a congenial home for people who share those values, those passionate interests in psychoanalysis and related fields. And that's how I think that we, as an association, can thrive. I think I would also say that I see us being very much part of an international community of psychoanalysts. And I think, to me, that is hugely important for reasons that may be obvious and not obvious. I think it's a psychoanalytic movement that we're talking about here, and it's a global movement that should in no way be restricted by geographic boundaries. And I think that we also have so much to learn from colleagues in different countries who speak different languages and who may have different theoretical persuasions. And so I see APSA as being very much a part of a global united community of psychoanalysts, because I think we're going to be stronger together.
Well, I think one of the effects of this pandemic on practices has certainly been to loosen everyone up in terms of the kind of practice they're doing and the way that everyone is thinking about practicing. And I suspect it will lead to greater flexibility in terms of everyone's practice once this is over with.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that there's so much to be learned during this period of time about practicing more flexibly. I think analysts, frankly, are fortunate in that our work involves listening and speaking. And so we are in a profession that will lend itself more to using these virtual technologies, but I think we can also never underestimate the incredible importance of being physically in the same room with another human being, and I would never diminish that. I think that as this pandemic wears on, Steve, I think that the absence of human touch, of human contact, since we're inherently social animals, is going to become even more. I think it's impossible to even anticipate exactly what those effects are. It's hard to know. But the other thing I would say that I think applies to the future of psychoanalysis in the wake of this pandemic is that the emotional consequences of the pandemic are already enormous. Maybe we'll talk about that in a bit, but the emotional toll is enormous, and I think, sadly, will probably get a lot worse before it starts to get better as people are suffering from increasing periods of isolation and some of the other consequences of the way we're having to live right now. So I think the need for psychoanalysis and its offshoots, clinically and otherwise, has never been greater, I think it's a time that could be, unfortunately, but also fortunately, I suppose, a kind of golden moment for psychoanalysts, because people are going to want to heal from this. People are going to want to make meaning from this. People are going to want to reflect on the experience when we have the fortunate time when we can actually look back on it rather than living through it acutely. So it could be a real moment for a psychoanalytic renaissance.
I certainly think that's true. Let me shift gears a bit, Kerry. Right now, I know that you have been spending a great deal of your time speaking with leaders about their organizations, how they are navigating this moment. I'm curious to hear, and I'm sure the audience is curious to hear, what your approach has been with leaders of organizations and how you've used your analytic background, your analytic thinking to help leaders at this particular moment.
Well, you know, my analytic background informs everything I do, Steve, and that's been the case as a consultant, as an advisor to CEOs and management teams and boards over the last 25 years. So being informed by that psychoanalytic perspective and by the psychoanalytic values that I was alluding to a few moments ago, that hasn't changed. Of course, the conversations have changed dramatically over the last 3 weeks since the pandemic really exploded in this way. It has been a complicated and challenging few weeks from a work perspective. You know, in my day job, if you will, I spend most of my days speaking with CEOs and management teams and boards. Now, all we are talking about is how to help these leaders navigate themselves and their organizations through these truly unprecedented times. And one of the ways that I have been framing it, and frankly, I'm learning as we go. It's not like I was particularly prepared for this. I had these relationships with leaders, but we've never dealt with this before. One of the ways I've been framing the conversations as they've evolved over the last few weeks, and I've been speaking, I should add, not only with individual leaders, but with large groups of them, sometimes up to 15,000 people on a call, which has been also rather surreal to do that virtually. But I've been framing the discussion in one way that I think I have certainly found helpful, and I hope others do too, which is that to say that there's not just one pandemic right now. There are really two concurrent pandemics. The first one, of course, is the pandemic of the virus. But the second one that is closely tied to the first is a pandemic of anxiety. And I want to be really clear that I'm not just using that as a figure of speech. I'm actually quite serious about that. I think that anxiety is reaching epidemic proportions, and I think it has major consequences for how all of us, and certainly how leaders of organizations of any size, lead. And I think that even by trying to raise consciousness in leaders about some of the effects of these high-level and long-lasting anxiety, that can help them lead better. To be more specific, what I'm referring to is, for instance, how it's well known to psychoanalysts that high levels of anxiety can interfere with our ability to think clearly, with our ability to perceive reality accurately. And if you think about that, being able to think clearly and perceive reality accurately are two of the essential factors that allow people to make sound decisions, including sound decisions for organizations that we are leading. So I think by calling attention to the effects of anxiety, it might mitigate some of those and help leaders be more grounded in reality. I've also been talking about how there's a spectrum of anxiety that exists out there in general and is certainly more acute right now. If you think of anxiety on one end of the spectrum being denial, the denial of the anxiety, and at the other end of the spectrum, the other extreme, being outright panic and hysteria, these are certainly forms of defending against anxiety that that analysts are extremely familiar with. Both ends of the spectrum, the extremes, denial on one hand, panic on the other, are clearly not adaptive for all of us, particularly those who are looking out for others, leading organizations, taking care of patients or families. And so I think it's so important to call attention to those extremes and to help people understand if they are veering towards one or the other. And somewhere in the middle of the spectrum is what I would describe as a healthy and more adaptive level of anxiety and concern. Of course, it's hard to locate that middle, particularly as the crisis continues to unfold. But I think that the right amount, if you will, of anxiety is actually highly adaptive because it's part of what motivates us to take appropriate action and to take care of ourselves first and then to be able to take care of others. I do think that's something that I'm emphasizing a lot, is that we need to be tuned into our own anxieties and other emotional states right now to be able to then empathize with others and respond appropriately to other people's needs. The other area that I would go into right now regarding leaders is that this should be leaders' finest moment. Unfortunately, I'm not seeing that all the time, but the best leaders are rising to the occasion. They also know that they are going to be scrutinized like never before as to how they conduct themselves during this crisis. And these leaders need to be leading with their values, with a care and concern for people's well-being and for the public health, for the public good first, and then for other concerns about the organization, whether it's the profit motive or keeping programs going. That is very important, but comes second. So these are some of the kinds of things that I've been talking about, Steve, and I can elaborate on any of it if you'd like.
Yeah, you know, Kerry, I thought it would be helpful. We have a quote here from John Barry, who wrote The Great Influenza of 1918, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history. And I think it's worth reading this in the context of what you've said about the pandemic of anxiety and what leaders can and cannot do to help to stem the sense of panic. So I'll be interested in your reaction to this, but this is the end of his book where he says, in 1918, the lies of officials and of the press never allowed the terror to condense into the concrete. The public could trust nothing, and so they knew nothing. Society is ultimately based on trust. As trust broke down, people became alienated, not only from those in authority, but from each other. So a terror seeped into the society that prevented one woman from caring for her sister, that prevented volunteers from bringing food to families too ill to feed themselves, and who starved to death because of it, that prevented trained nurses from responding to the most urgent calls for their services. The fear, not the disease, threatened to break the society apart. As Victor Vaughan, a careful man, a measured man, a man who did not overstate a point, warned, civilization could have disappeared within a few more weeks. So the final lesson of 1918, a simple one, yet most difficult to execute, is that those who occupy positions of authority must lessen the panic that can alienate all with the society. Society cannot function if it is every man for himself. By definition, civilization cannot survive that. Those in authority must retain the public's trust. The way to do this is to distort nothing, put their best face on nothing to try to manipulate no one. Lincoln said that first and best. A leader must make whatever horror exists concrete. Only then will people be able to break it apart.
Yeah, Steve, I'm familiar with that passage from Barry's book, and I think it's profoundly important and prescient. It's completely applicable today. It's very consistent, and he says it far better than I do when I talk about the pandemic of anxiety. But I think we're talking about the same thing, and particularly the role of leaders in mitigating that panic. You know, what I tell the leaders that I talk to, and the best ones intuitively get this, that the role of leaders is not just to give hope, it's to give hope that's rooted in reality. And we have to give people the benefit of the doubt. People can smell when a leader is trying to put a positive gloss on things to make them sound better than they really are, when the leader, him or herself, is not grounded firmly in the facts as they're known at that time, and if the facts change, then the leader needs to admit that and to go with the new facts. So we've seen profound failures certainly here in the U.S., in my view, profound failures of leadership at the highest levels of government, in which our leaders are trying to put positive spins on things, or in denial, or sending very contradictory messages, whether it's about, you know, something as concrete as the recommendation to use face coverings when you go outside, but then saying that he's not going to use a face covering himself. I mean, that's a mixed message and is very confusing to a lot of his followers. That's poor leadership, in my view. And we need leaders right now who take a stand and just tell us the truth. That's what we want to know. We want to know the truth. And the truth, and feeling that our leaders are grounded in reality, that is far better at giving hope than making up some kind of fairy tale.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's obviously important for leaders to try to help their organizations continue to maintain themselves as communities. Could you say some about how you're trying to help leaders help their organizations to do that? Like you had said a few minutes ago that you're seeing some leaders that are not doing the kinds of things that you're suggesting. I just had a recent experience where in speaking with an attorney who said that since this has all happened and since everyone is working virtually, there's been no contact with upper management whatsoever, no communication. Everyone is off on their own and with absolutely no connection. I was flabbergasted by that, of course, but it's a reality.
It is, it's disturbing to hear. And unfortunately, you do hear some of those stories about leaders who are sort of vanishing right now, when in fact the opposite should be the case. They should be exceedingly present. You know, one of the biggest challenges right now is that most workers are, of course, being told to stay home unless they are so-called essential workers who have to go into, whether it's a factory or a warehouse, or healthcare workers working on the front lines of the health crisis itself. And we need to be, first of all, extremely grateful to those workers who don't have the, I'm not sure I'd call it a luxury exactly, but the ability to work virtually. We need to make sure that we're not inadvertently creating a kind of two-class system of those who can work virtually and those who can't. But given that most people are being told to stay home, appropriately so, of course, there are lots of challenges to working virtually. And so one of the tasks for leaders of organizations and of countries, for that matter, too, is to help provide some of the social glue that allows those bonds that take place amongst people in organizations and even in countries to be sustained at a time when the ordinary means for sustaining those social bonds is impossible. We take it for granted that when we go to work every day, if we meet with colleagues, we're hanging around with them and talking and exchanging stories, and it's very difficult to do that right now. And so we do have to rely on these virtual technologies to do that, and they can approximate these social interactions to some degree, but it's not quite the same. Leaders need to be out there very present right now, communicating frequently. I think leaders shouldn't go more than a week without communicating with those that they're leading. Sometimes even every day is appropriate, and they ideally should be communicating in a way that is both auditory and visual, not just written with an email or something like that. Because I think we have a hunger to see our leaders, to connect with them. And so the more we can get their visual presence and their voice, I think it allows for that emotional bond to remain. I think there's also a permission granting aspect of leadership. And what I'm referring to there is that I think leaders need to be modeling, because we often model and identify with our leaders and behave accordingly, and to be modeling the importance of maintaining these social ties. They need to be modeling a kind of tolerance and kindness right now, as a kind of forgiveness for some of the foibles that we might get annoyed by if we were just going to the office and found a coworker annoying. So I think that measure of tolerance for imperfections, for having to juggle the demands of trying to continue to work and to be productive with having, whether it's having young children at home and juggling that, or being at home and grappling with the emotional complexities of increasing feelings of isolation and loneliness, or living in close quarters with other people, and feeling the lack of privacy. There are all sorts of permutations. And one of the roles of leaders is to be empathetic and sensitive to the different challenges that people are having, to assume that they have good intent. Some of the bad leaders that I've seen, frankly, over the last few weeks are those who, instead of leading with those kinds of assumptions and values, they lead with productivity overall, and with the kind of assumption that people are sort of slacking off and being lazy at home since they're not being checked on. That's terrible leadership. And in organizations where I've seen that happening, I must say it's the minority of them, but it is happening out there. Then these leaders are confused as to why their workers, whether they're virtual workers or essential workers on site, are practically mutinous because they don't respond emotionally well to that kind of leadership and don't want to work for those kinds of leaders anymore. So the role of leadership right now in getting these values out there and granting permission for people to work in a different way and to maintain the culture of the organization and to think of organizations as not just a business or an association, but to use the word you use, Steve, it's the right one, a community. And community has never been more important than it is right now.
Well, Kerry, I really want to thank you for speaking with us. It's been very enlightening, and it's great to have you on the podcast. It's great to have you as one of the leaders of our organization moving forward.
Thank you. Can I make one last comment, Steve?
Sure, please.
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and by extension with all of your listeners here. I think that that this Off the Couch podcast that you and Harvey have been doing has just been a great service to the profession worldwide. So I'm grateful for that. I just wanted to say one more thing about the effect of anxiety on all of us, not just psychoanalysts, but all humans right now. And my focus, as you know, Steve, has been on leaders, but we are either leaders or we are the led, and sometimes we're both. And that is that one of the other profound effects of anxiety on the way we think, and again, this is something that psychoanalysts really do have a deep understanding of, is that high levels of anxiety focus our attention on the immediate and the very short term. It's totally natural, totally understandable that when we are really anxious, like we all are now, that we're focused on how am I going to get through the next day or the next week? And do I have enough food in the refrigerator for my family? Or how am I going to keep my practice going? How do I take care of a loved one? So while that immediate term focus is totally understandable, we also need to be on guard against letting that consume us and crowd out the ability to also think further into the future. We need to keep one eye focused on the longer term, even if it may be hard to do right now. And I think it's important for two quick reasons. One is that there will be a future past this coronavirus pandemic. We will get through it, even if it's going to be a bumpy road, and undoubtedly it will. And so we need to be planning for that. We also need to be thinking of opportunities and learnings to be had along the way. And there will be both. But the other reason, which I'll just wrap up with here, Steve, is that I think it's important for leaders to be thinking about the future for another reason, and that's an emotional one. And that is that hope is in short supply right now, and I think thinking about the future is one way that we can give hope. And so I think it's important for all of us, but especially those who lead others, to be thinking about and talking about and reminding others that there will be a future past this pandemic, albeit a changed one. And it's something for us to look forward to.
I appreciate that, Kerry, very much. Thank you again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, we can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.